Greetings and welcome to the January ADA audio conference session. We will conduct a sound check with our speakers prior to getting underway today. Julie, if you would do a sound check, please.
Just testing, 1, 2, 3, can you hear me?
Thank you. Barry, can you do a sound check, please?
Hi, Peter, check, 1, 2, 3.
All right. All right, very good. Jeff, would you start today's session, please?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Employment First conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the speaker presentation, there will be a question and answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Peter Berg from Great Lakes ADA Center. Thank you. Please go ahead, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. I will be the moderator for today's session. Welcome, everyone across the country, to the January ADA audio conference session titled Employment First. So for those of you wanting to know what Employment First is, or for those of you seeking information, you have come to the correct place. So welcome to 2020, everyone. The ADA audio conference is a project of the federally funded ADA National Network. The National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. To get more information about the ADA National Network and the center that serves your area, there are 10 regional ADA centers across the country. Visit the National Network's website, adata.org, or you can call the toll-free number to get in touch with your regional center, 800-949-4232. As mentioned, today's session is being recorded. The archive, along with the handouts, will be available within 24 hours and a few weeks. Following that, we will get an edited version of the program posted to the website. So thanks again to everyone for joining us, and thanks to our speakers for presenting. Our speakers today have a great deal of knowledge and information and interest in this topic of Employment First. So we are very pleased that they agreed to join us today and provide a presentation on Employment First. Our first speaker is Julie Christensen, and she is the Director of Policy with the Association of People Supporting Employment First. And we also have Barry Walle, who is the Project Director for the Southeast ADA Center, one of the 10 federally funded ADA centers down there in the Southwest out of Atlanta, Georgia. So, there will be a opportunity to ask questions following today's presentation. For those of you on the telephone, jot down your questions. We'll give you an opportunity to ask them. For those of you that are in the webinar room, you can submit your questions while the presentation is ongoing. When we get to that point, we will get those questions to our speakers. So at this time, I would like to welcome and turn the session over to Julie and Barry. So Julie and Barry, it's all yours.
Yep. Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. And I want to thank the the Great Lakes ADA Center for sponsoring this session and inviting us, and also the University of Illinois Chicago. So thank you so much. Happy New Year, everybody. As Peter said, I am the director of the Southeast ADA Center based in Atlanta. We are a project of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse University. So we are one of those 10 centers that Peter mentioned that are federally funded by NIDLR. So what I want to do is just kind of have a little foundational knowledge in preparation for talking about Employment First. You know, and what the intersection is between Employment First and the ADA. The ADA is civil rights law. It is not preferential treatment for people. It is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in all areas of public life. So that would include equality in employment, civic participation, the opportunity to have equality in transportation and education in all public and private places and places open to the general public. So, you know, when we look at the population of our country, the number of people with disabilities is growing. Some estimates are between 88 and 92 million, depending on which numbers you're looking at. We were having a conversation earlier today. The number of people with psychiatric disabilities has spiked significantly in the past 20 years. And also acquired disability has increased. As our population ages, more and more people are impacted in their life by an acquired disability. And so this is an excellent opportunity for us to have this conversation today. Employment First is gaining momentum nationally, either by legislative order or by executive order. And as Julie will discuss in a few minutes, what a better time for us to talk about Employment First and the opportunities it has for people with disabilities than in our 30th anniversary year of celebrating the ADA. And just to remind you folks, if you've not checked out the Celebrate the ADA website, you can go to adaanniversary.org, where you will find a toolkit with all sorts of information on the 30th anniversary celebration, as well as each month. So I urge you to take a look at that. So before I move on to slide number 16, Julie, this would be a perfect opportunity to kind of set the foundational information of Employment First and what it is and what it means for people. So I'll turn it over to you.
Sounds good. So yeah, I'm gonna move us to slide 16, and I will try to remember to articulate when I'm changing slides as I go along. But wanted to just mirror Barry's opening comments and just really appreciate the opportunity to be part of this discussion. As we look at the 30th anniversary of the ADA and how far we've come, but also how far we still have to go, it's a great opportunity to talk about employment, because we certainly have seen some great strides in increasing opportunities for employment, but we're not 100% there yet, and we're going to talk more about that during the course of today's conversation. But when we think about the ADA as being a policy foundation, and Barry talked a little bit about the different pillars and the goals of the ADA. We're going to bring that full circle towards the end of this presentation. But what the ADA does is provide us with a policy foundation and really a platform upon which we can start to talk about all of the individual pieces and parts of an inclusive lifestyle in the United States for Americans with disabilities, one of those being employment. We hear Employment First is a term that's thrown around a lot. One of the things I want to be very clear about is that Employment First is not in and of itself a policy. Employment First really is a movement, and I'm going to break down a little bit of the principles behind that. I think Employment First as a movement and a set of principles is a way of looking at how to shape policy in the post-ADA era to ensure that all of the systems and parts that are part of our state and federal infrastructure to support people with disabilities are thinking about the outcome of employment and how to break down any barriers to getting there. So I'm going to advance to the next slide and just very quickly tell you about APSE, the Association for People Supporting Employment First, and where we fit into the Employment First movement, because certainly this is not something that APSE owns. That being said, we are the only national organization that devotes the entirety of our work to Employment First, to expanding opportunities for employment for people with disabilities, for elevating awareness and understanding of the principles of Employment First, And we do this in a number of ways. So part of that is policy and advocacy, and I think that's really going to shape today's conversation and is the hat that I play in the National APSE office, but also through our professional development and through sharing of best practices and tools. APSE is a member-based organization. We currently have chapters in 40 states that are active. However, we have APSE members in all 50 states, all of the U.S. territories, and Canada. So we have a pretty extensive reach, and, you know, again, all working through those three core areas, policy and advocacy, professional development, and sharing of best practices and tools towards increasing employment outcomes. So what is Employment First? I am going to reference our APSE website where there's a full Employment First statement available. So there's a hyperlink to that on the slides from today's presentation that we encourage folks to take a look at. But quite simply, what Employment First is the philosophy that employment in the general workforce is the first and preferred outcome in the provision of publicly funded services for all working age citizens with disabilities. That's all disability. It's any level of disability. We do not define this as a cross disability initiative. And really what that means is that we believe very strongly that there needs to be accountability when we look at the way that federal policy shapes funding streams within states to ensure that employment is the first outcome, meaning the first goal that we want. Does that mean everybody gets there? That's a different conversation. We're going to talk about that in a second. But ensuring that employment is part of the conversation and that when individuals are interacting with the service system for supports and services, that employment is part of that discussion and that the service system is designed to create the supports behind and around each individual to make employment a reality, whatever that looks like for the individual. I did also want to mention that we have a Employment First Statement for Self-Advocates. So APSE worked very closely with the Green Mountain Self-Advocates and created a self-advocate version with plain language and visuals that also adds to the conversation about what Employment First is and what those principles are. So that's available for all of you as a resource as on the APSE website. But let me break those down for the purposes of today's conversation and just to talk about the basic principles behind the Employment First movement. So when we think about Employment First, we think about what is the end goal. And in that case, the way that APSE defines it is that someone
I'm sorry, can you hold on 1 second? We're having some people are saying they're having some difficulty hearing you. Are you on a headset? Can you adjust your headset on the? Can you go
ahead
and
try this? Is this better?
Yes. There we go.
Okay.
Can you one more time? Sound check. Just go ahead and
check
say
one,
hello.
1, 2, 3. Hello.
Perfect.
Okay. I'm seeing comments saying
good.
It's better. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
Okay, so when we think about Employment First, the way that APSE conceptualizes this is that it's a pathway. So the end goal, the gold standard for us is that every person with a disability who is self-directing that employment is their goal has an opportunity to achieve competitive integrated employment. And sorry, my screen just changed, so I can no longer see the slides. So let me just get myself to a place where I can see them. So we look at that as
hold on,
Claudia
is working on the PowerPoint for you.
Yep.
Hold.
And I can continue to chat while she does that. So that's the gold standard. That's what we would like to have available to every single person. That's linked to the definition of competitive integrated employment that is outlined in the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which is the WIOA, the current law of the land, so to speak. But we know that there is a continuum. And so when we think about this from the perspective of a service system, we know that individuals are going to come to the path towards employment from different places with different goals in mind, and that is okay. We are saying, as those of us who believe in employment first, that this is the goal that we are all working towards, and we are going to wrap around the supports to get folks as close to that goal as they are interested in going. So not it's a difference between setting our expectations at one level versus thinking about the barriers in the service system that make that a reality. And I think that's where the critical intersection of Employment First and the ADA becomes such a crucial factor, because we can want things, we can even know how to do it, but whether or not we have a service system that is that has the capacity to be able to support individual competitive employment utilizing natural supports for every individual, we obviously know that we are not 100% there yet. So let me move on to slide number 22. And talk about the basic principles. So the first and foremost is to increase the rate of employment for people with disabilities. So we know that there is a low participation rate currently, and we believe that this is unacceptable, that in the year 2020, we know what is required to support an individual regardless of their disability and the complicating factors of their disability. We have the track record and the examples to know that everybody can work when all of the right pieces and parts are put into place. And so that's what we're working towards, changing that dynamic so that we don't see people with disabilities having half the employment rate as the general population. So that's a critical component of all of the work of Employment First, is thinking about where we're at now, which is much better than it was before we had the ADA as a foundational policy to fall back on, but we still are not 100% there. We still don't have the same employment rate for people with disabilities as we do for Americans without disabilities. So that's our first principle. The second is around decreasing poverty and isolation. So we talk a lot about real jobs with real wages in the Employment First movement. That also aligns with WIOA's definition of competitive integrated employment. We know that people with disabilities are disproportionately more likely to live in poverty, to be isolated from the rest of the community, even when they are receiving services in the community. That does not necessarily mean the same as having decreased isolation. And so that's a piece that we think about in the forum of employment, is that we want to make sure that jobs and the availability of jobs do not socially isolate, and that the wages are competitive so that people who are in the workforce, people with disabilities in the workforce, are not discriminated against in terms of their wages and supports. So moving on to slide number 24, Employment First also presumes ability. So this goes back to that earlier slide where I had the arrow with the different options and the gold standard. So what we don't per se do in the Employment First era is say that any work is bad work. But what we do say is that we have an assumption that every single person, when they have the right supports and the right services, the right access to training, the opportunities, all of the other pieces of infrastructure, transportation, the ability to get out and network and in their community, if all of those things are in place for people with disabilities, then it's our assumption and our belief that people with disabilities can work just like anybody else. And that disability itself is not not the factor that gets in the way. Because again, we know, what supports and accommodations work, and we can, if the service system is aligned appropriately, can provide what is needed to make that happen. So this becomes a critical piece when we think about the definition of what is employment first, in that if someone is entering the service system, whether that's through vocational rehabilitation, whether that's through Medicaid, Social Security, whatever it is, that when someone is entering the service system, we presume, yes, this person can work. And it becomes inherent on the system to figure out how to support the person towards that outcome. Not that we take a look at someone and say, oh, well, you know, this person can't possibly work because of X, Y, and Z. So presuming ability is an important component of Employment First, as is normalizing supports, which is slide 25. So we also recognize that those very services and supports, wraparound services, accommodations, access to technology, whatever it is, having access to a job coach, has the potential to alienate and create a sense of this person is different in the workforce. So it's critical to us in Employment First to think of supports as just a normal part of being part of a work environment. So whatever assistance and support is needed should be available to help anyone succeed in the workplace, and that we are not we're not looking at this as a punitive, sets somebody apart and makes individuals with disabilities in the workforce feel that they are treated differently or otherwise are discriminated against for requiring those accommodations. The next principle is around promoting self-determination, and this is a difficult one to talk about, but also a critical one. You know, what happens when someone says, but I don't want to work? Do individuals have the ability to self-determine that work is not for them? And what APSE and Employment First would say is, well, in the same way that a person without a disability can make that choice, sure, no one's going to force you to work, but there are consequences for not working. And so promoting self-determination is a key component of this. It works both ways. It's ensuring that a person with a disability who has a career goal and is able to articulate this is what I want to do is supported to do that, but that it also is cognizant of and respectful of the opposite belief system of I don't want to work, I can't work, whatever the reason is, but then we need to be engaging in education around that is your choice, and here are the potential implications of that choice. So this isn't a forcing anyone to do anything, and again, not a critique of any type of employment, but helping to raise the bar, helping everyone assume competence and ability, and that competitive integrated employment always remains the goal that we are working towards to the extent that individuals self-direct that. So all of this requires that we ensure policy alignment. I'm on slide 27 now. And one of the things that I am often asked in my director of policy at APSE hat is, well, what is an Employment First policy? And my response is there's not an Employment First policy. You don't even have to call it Employment First as far as we're concerned, but we want to see these principles built within the policies that frame both our federally funded and our state and local funded systems and supports, so that our public policy direction is very clear, that employment for all citizens, including people with disabilities in the general workforce, remains the end goal, what we are working towards, that it's a priority, that we are not defaulting to services and supports that are non-employment simply because there is some form of a disability label or diagnosis, that we, again, all of these earlier principles apply that we've discussed, but that they are part of the policy alignment. This also means that our service systems are funded in a way that incentivize employment as an outcome. We know we're not 100% there yet, and there are many states that struggle in this regard. So a big part of the work is the education. It's the helping folks understand what the principles are, but then we have to really do the hard work at the state and in local level and also at the federal level to ensure that policies are aligned and reflect this so that the capacity is there. And all with the end goal on slide 28 of achieving competitive integrated employment. And so again, I mentioned that Employment First does not have those words. Employment First, again, it's a movement, it's a philosophy, it's not a defined check-the-box thing. If we have these components in our law, therefore we are an Employment First state. We hear that a lot, and that's a little bit of a stretch in terms of what we believe Employment First is about. We wanna make sure that we're looking at the underlying policies, how those are enacted, what are the procedures, what is the actual implementation, what is the infrastructure, is it aligned and supported to get the same outcomes that we say, because this is another issue with policy. We can say one thing, and then several steps down the line, you have a service coordinator in a local office telling an individual that they are better suited for rehabilitation than they are for supported employment. You can have the best policies in the world, but if you are not implementing and if you don't have the infrastructure, the funding supports, and everything else aligned to support those outcomes, then there's a disconnect and we have not achieved the goal. Again, it's a reason why we stress, it being about principles rather than policy, because policy is a place to start. It's a place to fall back on. And a great way to think about that in 2020, as we think about the 30th anniversary of the ADA, is that we know while we have a policy, we have a law, there are still many barriers to access for people with disabilities. So the same thing applies in Employment First. Just getting that policy is not enough. It's the ability to implement that policy and for that to actually translate into impact on individual lives is really what we care about. With that being said, and now I'm on slide 29, we are often asked, well, what is the state of Employment First around the country? So in some way, shape, or form, we could say that every state in the country has some sense of an Employment First initiative taking place, with the caveat of the state of Nebraska. Now, let me talk about Nebraska, because I would argue that there's quite a bit that is happening in the state of Nebraska that supports Employment First in principle and implementation. However, the way that we have started to track this over time is to look at, does the state have actual state legislation or a directive or executive order? So for those who are looking on this, the slide, there are green states that reflects when that is the case. You can have just legislation, no executive order. Those are the yellow states. You could have just a directive or an executive order, but no legislation. That's the blue states. And then there's this sort of other category. And so on one hand, we can say every state is doing something. We don't place a hierarchy on what color your state is, because if you cross-reference this against employment outcomes, you do not see clear patterns. You don't see, for example, the states that have legislation have higher outcomes, because it's more complicated than that. We have states that are doing other activities. Iowa is a great example of that, that is doing really innovative things, but does not have a directive, executive order, or legislation. And conversely, you have states that, are green states, but do not necessarily have incredible outcomes. Mississippi is an example of that. So again, we track it in the sense that movement in policy is important, because it's that platform that we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. In the same way that the ADA is a platform that we build upon, Employment First principles embedded in policy is also a platform that we build upon, but that's not the goal. The goal is improving outcomes, and that we know we still have a long way to go. So moving into slide 30, there's a lot that is happening in the federal policy space right now that is aligned with the principles of Employment First, that either historically leading all the way up to current day. So what this slide includes is kind of just a quick snapshot of the ways that we've built upon from a policy context Employment First as a goal. And you'll see that the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990 was not the beginning of this conversation. We had the Rehabilitation Act before that. And since the ADA was signed in 1990, we've continued to build on that because we are not 100% there yet. So moving as recently as 2014, when we put into law for the first time a definition of competitive integrated employment, what does that mean and how are states accountable for showing progress towards that? So this is something we continue to work on, both at the federal level and at the state level, but we're not 100% there yet. The next slide, 31, is just a little bit more background on the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which I've mentioned. The only thing I will add is that in addition to the competitive integrated employment outcome defined, WIOA also really pushed quality of workforce services and ensuring that there is access to supports and services that lead to competitive integrated employment. That's a critical component from the federal level of helping states understand that within their state plans, competitive integrated employment and ensuring that individuals working in those systems to support people with disabilities towards that outcome understand what that means and that they're receiving high quality services. So again, that's the goal, that's the platform that we're building on. Now the work is really at the implementation level and how we make that happen within the individual context of the geography of a particular state, which we know varies quite a bit across the country. So let me just give you a sense of the status of competitive integrated employment right now. I will mention that we do have on the APSE website, we have resource sheets that give this information at a national level, but also for every individual state. So we look at competitive employment from APSE's perspective of really being about the wages. So an individual is being paid at least minimum wage and comparable wages to what a coworker without a disability would be paid for doing the same work. One of the things we're very much involved in right now is the continued use of 14C certificates under the Fair Labor Standards Act and the use of subminimum wage, which is also allowable under Medicaid. That one's harder to track, but we are looking very closely at the continued use of 14C certificates, and so we do know that there are right around 100,000 individuals with disabilities around the country that are not working in competitive environments as defined by this definition of looking at wage. When we look at the integration, that's where we're really breaking down what setting is somebody working in. So we have a lot of facility-based employment in this country, and we have a much smaller segment of the pie that is integrated employment in the community. So this is something we really want to take a look at. This is Medicaid data, which is all that we really have available to track on an ongoing basis. But again, if our policy or under WIOA is that, integrated employment, competitive integrated employment is the outcome, then we have a lot of work to do given the high percentage of individuals who are receiving Medicaid dollars that are receiving services in non-integrated settings, in facility-based or in non-work settings. And then when we think about employment as a whole, just the rate of employment, we see, how people with disabilities are significantly disadvantaged and are not working at the same rate as the general population. And depending on what type of disability you have, the outcomes are even more dire. So this gives us a sense, a little bit of a benchmark. Now, again, you know, we could go back before the ADA and pull some of these numbers, and we have made progress. That is the good news. But, you know, policy, we celebrate when policy happens, but we continually have to go back to what was the intent of the law and are we implementing with fidelity, and what are the mechanisms that we can hold systems accountable when we are not getting the outcomes that the law was designed to ensure happened. So again, you can get individual state sheets that tell you what's going on in competitive integrated employment in your state on the APSE website. And if you have difficulty finding them, you're welcome to reach out to me and I can help you navigate those. So we want to continue to address the employment gap. If all things were aligned and the ADA was fully realized, then part of absolute access is that we should see people with disabilities employed at least the same rate as everybody else. So work to do there, but a strong policy platform on which we can build and continue to make progress. So how do we get there? So we continue to, as APSE, I will say, we continue to do work in the three areas I mentioned. We do a lot in the area of professional development. So the piece I mentioned earlier about making sure that the workforce that is supporting employment for people with disabilities is of high quality. That includes things like certification for job coaches and job developers to ensure, you know, minimum criteria of expertise. We do a lot of sharing of best practices, and just because this is my piece of the APSE pie, we're doing a lot of work in the public policy space. So slide 37, which is where I'm at right now, just lists the policy priorities in the current Congress and the areas that we are working towards as APSE to continue to address some of these issues. And we, while we are working on this at the federal level, we are also partnered in states that are taking on pieces and parts. So whether that's, you know, looking at expansion of ABLE accounts or it's phasing out the use of 14C, you know, all of these pieces are part of it. But as I pivot back to Barry to even more purposefully make the connection between the ADA and Employment First than I'm sure I've managed to do, preserving protections under the ADA continues to be something that we have to pay attention to. Even 30 years later, we continually see opportunities to take back pieces and parts of what we have accomplished through the passage of the ADA. So APSE takes a very strong stance in ensuring that we preserve the protections that we currently have, that the ADA remains that framework, that policy platform on which we can continue to build, and that any subsequent policy gains that we make are to further our progress and to ensure the outcomes we want and not in any way to take a step back. So, Barry, I think I'm pivoting back to you to take it home.
Yeah, thank you, Julie. That fantastic information. So what I wanted to do is to spend the remainder of our time kind of circling back around to the four goals or the four pillars of ADA and the Employment First and kind of overlay the two and see how they interconnect. So I am on slide 38 right now. And so thinking about those four pillars of the ADA, full participation, independent living, equality of opportunity, and economic self-sufficiency. So how do they align with Employment First as a movement? So I'm going on to slide 39 now. And I want to talk for a few minutes about full participation. So when we talk about full participation, we're talking about removing barriers. And those barriers are physical, they are virtual, Those barriers may include communication barriers in many different levels, as well as those barriers that are developed by our unconscious biases. So in both policy and practice, so that people with disabilities have equal and full participation. So when I'm thinking about those biases and those unconscious biases, Julie had alluded to both the unemployment rate and the labor force participation rate. So when we look at those in December, which, you know, if you don't look at the ODEP numbers every month, you should, we see that the unemployment rate for people who do not identify as having a disability is 3.2%. So, and these are the December numbers again. So when you compare that to the unemployment rate for people who do identify as having a disability, those numbers shoot to 7%. So far over double the unemployment rate for people who do not have disabilities, which is, a primary reason why Employment First and employment is the first and preferred option for people becomes so important. Comparing that 3.2%, which virtually is full employment right now in this country, versus that 7%, it's a very dire situation. But of course, that's only half the equation, right? So we have to look at labor force participation as well. Labor force participation for people who do not identify as having a disability, 68.7%. Versus for people who do identify as having a disability, the labor force participation rate drops to only 20.5%. So essentially another way of looking at that is 79%, 79.5% of people with disabilities are on the economic sideline. They're not even looking for work. They are not in the labor market. Moving on to slide number 40, so is full participation, how does it align with Employment First? And some of the information on these slides comes directly from APSE's statements on Employment First and their policy. So is it Employment First? Are there underlying policies, procedures, infrastructures, as Julie mentioned, designed for and ultimately result in increased integrated employment opportunities in the general workforce for people with disabilities. So, as we talk about integrated employment, what do we mean by that? You know, those are the work settings where people with significant disability can work alongside people who do not identify as having a disability, and that their wages, as Julie mentioned, and their benefits are comparable to other employees. And I will even take it a step further and say, not only are you working alongside people who do not have identify as having disabilities with comparable wages and benefits, but that as an employee with a disability, that you're valued for your talent and you're valued for those skills that you bring to that workplace or the labor market in general. So we're on slide 41 now. Is it employment first, full participation? We have to ask, do all working age adults and youth with disabilities work and fully integrated within the general workforce, working side by side with those coworkers without disabilities, earning minimum wage or higher? And that minimum wage is very important. Slide 42. And these numbers are going to be adjusted slightly from the December numbers for workforce participation and unemployment. These are the annual numbers from the most recent reporting period, which would be 2018. So in looking at this, the employment population ratio or workforce participation for 2018 stood at 19.1% versus 65.9% for people who didn't identify or do not identify as having a disability. Now, this is a very interesting statistic. In looking at employment outcomes for people with disabilities, if you have a disability, 31% of the workforce who have a disability reported that they worked in part-time employment. as opposed to 15% for people who do not identify as having a disability. So a lot of the jobs that people are getting are part-time work. Now, that may be circumstance of disability. That might include uncertainty as for the impact of your wages on federal benefits. But what we see are people are not working, or many people are not working, who choose to work at their potential or where they would prefer to be. Interestingly, when you look at all levels of education, there doesn't seem to be an impact on unemployment or workforce participation. So, you know, that's a little puzzling, is that regardless of educational attainment, you are less likely to be employed than people who do not identify as having a disability. So let's move on to the second pillar, and I'm on slide 43 now. This is the pillar of independent living. And what this slide says is no one should be denied dignity, they should not be identified or not denied choice, and they should not be denied, no one should be denied the equality of opportunity in all aspects of daily life. And most importantly, the people who live with disabilities should be considered the overall expert on what they need to live a full life. So when we apply this to employment first, you know, how did those wages that you earn, how do those wages help you to live independently? A story I often tell about independent living, I have a very good friend of mine who went into a group home facility. This is, gosh, maybe 25, 30 years ago. I may date myself at this point. And he goes in to meet with a fellow who was living in the group home and noticed that there were a bunch of boxes packed up in his room. And so my friend said, "Oh, are you moving?" And the other fellow said, "Yeah, I'm moving tomorrow." And my friend said, "So where are you moving to?" And the fellow said, "I don't know. They haven't told me yet." So in regard to independent living, that certainly in that situation, that individual was denied dignity, was denied choice, and was denied any equal opportunity to live a full and meaningful life as anybody else. Very frustrating story. So moving on to slide number 44, you know, Julie had mentioned, I think it was in slide 25, referencing assistance necessary for people in order to be successful in the workforce. So in regard to independent living, is it employment first? So it's presumed that all working age adults and youth with disabilities, if they choose to, can work in jobs fully integrated within the general workforce, working side by side with coworkers who do not have disabilities. That access should be there for supports necessary to succeed in the workforce. Now, when we're talking about those supports can be generic or they can be designed. So what I mean by that is some supports just naturally fall into place because of the people that you work with. I've worked in the field of supported employment for a number of years and can't tell you how many times when it just friendships evolve naturally. And as a result of those friendships, then generic supports just evolve and are put into place. Sometimes those supports are designed by the presence of a job coach or by some sort of training opportunity for that person with a disability. But the key to this is that people in supported employment services have the opportunity to engage in discovery, to take a look at the conditions, the preferences, the contributions that would make you successful on the job. Also, opportunities for self-employment and micro-enterprises. For a number of years, I helped people start their own businesses, writing the business plan, finding the funding as an alternative to working for somebody else. Along with that, we see in our 21st century economy, I was having a conversation earlier today with somebody about the gig economy and how what are opportunities for people with disabilities to participate, and especially younger people to participate in the gig economy. But ultimately, independent living, the right to pursue the full range of available employment opportunities for folks. So let's move on to slide number 45. So now we want to talk about equality of opportunity. So the ADA ensures that people who have disabilities have equality in their public life, where they work, schools, transportation, and commercial establishments. Here's a quote at the signing by George H.W. Bush on the signing of the ADA, that letting the shameful wall of exclusion finally to come tumbling down for people. So what do we mean by equality of opportunity? And that should be that there are a range of options for folks in the workforce, not simply the popular employer of the month or an employer that has extraordinary turnover rates because those jobs are easy. If we are engaging in employment first, if we are engaging in equality of opportunity, then we are taking the time to get to know somebody and to understand what their contributions are. So moving on to slide number 46, when we're talking about equality of opportunity, we're talking about working at a job you want to do. And as Julie mentioned, and I'll mention again in a few minutes, that you have the opportunity to work for a fair and competitive range wage. Most importantly, and I see this a lot over my years of work, is that there are opportunities for career advancement. It's always frustrating to me when somebody gets a job and then you see a piece on the TV news or on the in print media, you know, somebody who worked for 35 years at a McDonald's and retired, doing the same job and never having that opportunity for advancement. So there needs to be that equality of opportunity as well, that there's opportunity for advancement. Access to goods and services, and that's both physical and virtual. We live in a virtual economy to some extent now, and thank goodness for, I won't mention a brand name, but Amazon, that I don't have to leave the comfort of my couch to buy stuff. But that needs to be accessible to all people. Banking and financial security. We know that people who have disabilities are unbanked or are underbanked at rates much higher than people who do not have disabilities. So we want to know why that is. What do banks do to reach out to people make sure that they're customers and that they feel comfortable in using traditional banking? Also, Julie had mentioned ABLE accounts before, and we'll talk about that in economic self-sufficiency in a moment. So the opportunity to enjoy leisure and recreation of your choice and then also to have affordable health care, basically to have a good life. We also know that people who have disabilities have disproportionate health care costs. And we need to make sure that healthcare is attainable and affordable for everybody. Moving on to slide number 47, is it employment first, this equality of opportunity? Young people with disabilities should have work experiences that are typical of other teenagers and young adults. You know, we often get into finding a job for somebody without realizing that when you are a young adult, there should be that period of discovery where you try to find yourself and try to find out, you know, for lack of a better word, what you're good at, right? Three sons who are in their early to mid-20s who are still trying to find that out. They're working on it. I have an 18-year-old daughter who's currently working at a Mexican restaurant. That should not be her one and only job, nor should it be for anybody. So that's part of equality of opportunity as well. And that citizens with disabilities have greater opportunity to advance their career by taking full advantage of individual strengths and talents. So, you know, I mentioned this before. I had a good friend who would say people were stable because they were stranded, or stranded because they were stable, I'm sorry, meaning that they went into a job and because there weren't any issues, that they end up staying there so many years without having opportunity to advance their career. So moving on to slide number 48, the final pillar of the ADA is economic self-sufficiency. So this slide says economic self-sufficiency is the ability of individuals and families to maintain sufficient income to meet basic needs with minimal reliance on public subsidy in food, in housing, utilities, wellness, transportation, dependent care, the clothes you wear. So, you know, we know that people have a higher standard of living when they are earning a competitive wage and they are in the workforce. So this is the alignment between employment first and the ADA for economic self-sufficiency. And that also includes opportunities for wealth building as well. We had talked about before, Julie had mentioned ABLE accounts. So ABLE is just a wonderful opportunity for people who would otherwise not have opportunity to engage in wealth building and to have some sort of financial security to attain that security. So is it employment first? You know, we've talked about this before, earning a minimum wage or higher, earning a living wage in a job of that employee's choosing based on their talents, their skills, and their interests, and that people with disabilities have increased income, financial assets, and economic health. You know, Julie had mentioned in slides 32 to 34, I think, there was a discussion of these 14 C certificates. And 14 C in 1938, when you consider the context of that, you know, we're in the depths of the Depression. People with disabilities were not in the labor force, and very few people, even without disabilities, were in the labor force. So at the time, 14C may have been a good example to stimulate economy, to stimulate the workforce, an incentive in the Depression era for people to go to work. But here in the 21st century, we see that all the 14C certificates do is restrict economic self-sufficiency for workers in those settings. If we care about economic self-sufficiency, then we need to ensure that people have a living wage and are earning to their maximum capacity. So those are the alignments of employment first with ADA. And with that, that was my last slide. If you have questions, and I know you do because I've seen some come up, I want to first of all let you see our contact information. You can reach me at B.A. Whaley, that's B-A-W-H-A-L-E-Y, at law.syr.edu. And there's Julie's email, julie@apsi.org. Hers is a lot easier than mine. So, Julie, I'll turn it over to both of us for whatever questions folks may have. And Peter?
All right. Thank you both, Julie and Barry, for all of that great information. I'm going to ask our operator, Jeff, if you could come back quickly and give our telephone participants instructions on how they can ask questions. For those of you in the webinar room, you can continue to submit your questions in the chat area. But, Jeff, if you can give instructions to telephone participants, please.
Certainly, sir. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, you may press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
All right, and while we do that, we'll start tackling the questions that already came in. One of the questions had to do with Illinois, which has submitted a plan and a question, and Julie has responded to this, that they that she has forwarded that on to the folks, that Illinois should be in the green, a colored green. So the individual that asked that question or other folks from Illinois asking about that, that is being addressed. A follow-up question from Illinois, from that individual, was that the state has just released an updated unified plan under WIAO, and they wanted to know, are there things that you would recommend that advocates emphasize in comments to the plan to ensure that it is implemented in accordance with Employment First?
I'm just sorry, I'm a visual processor, so I'm reading the question, so I make sure that I fully understand it. Barry, feel free to jump in. You know, I think I would refer back to, you know, some of those basic principles that we outlined. You know, when we think about what should be in the plan, you know, are things like, you know, career counseling, regardless of whether or not you are currently participating in employment, is that happening? That should be specified in a way in your unified plan that makes sense and can be taken care of. I think, you know, that's a big one. The issue of subminimum wage is a complicated one. You know, Barry had, I thought, did a really nice job of talking about 14C and the place that it plays. However, there's also the ability to pay subminimum wage under, you know, through the Medicaid waiver. And that's a little known and often not discussed part of the conversation. So we are doing quite a bit of education there in trying to help advocates with some language to distinguish between the two, because they're not one and the same. And so it's, yes, we have a position on 14C, but the bigger issue is the ability to make minimum wage or more. And that goes back to a fundamental civil rights argument that, you know, I would say that where we landed with 14C, which ultimately influenced Medicaid waiver wages, that the law was never designed for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but we've applied it in that regard. So again, the principle of assuming ability plays in here, and if we are saying that people with disabilities under the ADA should have equal access, equal rights as everybody else, then that also means that they should not be held to an arbitrary productivity standard that people without disabilities doing the same work are not having to be subject to. So I always, when I talk about this, I talk about my personal experience that my first job as a 16-year-old was working at McDonald's, and I hated it, so I wasn't very productive. And I got paid the minimum wage. So why are we not making that the baseline? You know, that's an ADA issue. Barry, I don't know if there's more you want to add.
Well, yeah, no, but I think you make an excellent point, is that the intent of 14C versus who is being impacted by it now, it's so disproportionate that people with intellectual disability, cognitive disabilities are impacted at a far higher rate than other disability groups, which is very frustrating. And then there was something else I was going to say, but I forgot. Oh, I was going to say, you know, kind of your thought on working at McDonald's and you weren't very good at it. You know, a 14C certificate is based on a presumption that someone who does not have a disability operates at 100% of productivity 100% of the time. Don't tell my boss, but there are some days that I'm not quite as good as other days, you know?
Right.
So what an arbitrary standard that is.
Yeah, and I know the intent of the original question was what should be included in the unified plan. And so this is not, the question itself was not 14C and subminimum wage, but, you know, I think it goes back to that notion of, you know, are we prioritizing employment? And then what does that mean in terms of implementation? Are the funding structures aligned so that employment services are incentivized?
Right.
You know, these are all things that states can really take on and really define within their plans that would help move the needle.
Yeah.
All right, great. Thank you. And this was a question that received in advance. I think this is a good time to bring it up. And regarding, you know, how do you respond to families or, I guess more the questioner was asking more about, you know, families that feel that think that perhaps their family member, you know, if 14C certificates went away, that because of their family member's disability, that, you know, competitive employment is not an option and that, you know, the sheltered workshop is the only option for their family member. You know, how do you respond to, you know, to those types of comments?
Yeah, go ahead, Julia. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have many responses, and I have to take the emotionality out of it. But let me say this. One of the core principles of Employment First is self-direction. I have a fundamental issue with having an argument about what a family member presumes on behalf of an individual with a disability than what that individual themselves wants or needs. And so I would push back and say that if we are talking about self-directed supports and services, then I want to know that that individual has had all of the options, all of the education, all of the opportunities for discovery, this, that, and the other thing, and then self-determines that, nope, competitive integrated employment is not for me. That's a conversation I'm willing to have. What I'm not willing to have, just like I'm not willing to accept from a service system that based on diagnosis you say someone has to go into a rehabilitation program instead of supported employment, I'm not going to necessarily default to someone speaking on behalf simply because they're a family member. I know that that's a broad generalization, and this is a very complex conversation that we could spend an entire 90 minutes on and still not scratch the surface. But I would push back on the self-directed piece of this and whose voice is it we should be hearing from.
Excellent. And then quick, Barry, hold on one second. So just a quick follow-up, Julie. You know, so what types of sports and supports and training and education is then out there to, you know, fully inform individuals about Employment First so that they can make that, you know, that determination themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question, and I think one of the things that WIOA had tried to accomplish, and you know that now it's the issue of how well are we implementing, is that career counseling and job discovery is supposed to be available to every single person so that they can have that opportunity to make that self-directed choice themselves based on real information. We know the implementation of that is difficult. And for a variety of reasons, including lack of capacity and lack of funding to be able to provide that type of support for every single person. But that is the intent of WIOA, is to ensure that the service system is making that possible. It is much easier for us to address this when we are talking about school-age folks who are aging out and moving into the adult support system. I think we're doing a better job there, but that doesn't negate our responsibility to people who entered the service system before the ADA, before WIOA, and you know have spent decades in pre-vocational services without an opportunity, a true opportunity to look at something else.
That's very true. Yeah, and you know, early in my career, I worked in day activity centers and sheltered type environments, and you know the opportunity for anybody who I have ever worked alongside. To work in competitive employment with the proper supports, I believe is there. And as Julie mentioned, if you go back to the intent of WIOA and you look at the PRE-ETS, the pre-employment transition services, you know, looking at job exploration, looking at workplace readiness, as well as a very important piece that Julie alluded to is the instruction in how to be a self-advocate, how to mm-hmm. make your needs known.
All right, great, thank you. All right, I'm going to go on to the next question, then we'll check in a moment to see if we have any questions on the phone. This one that had come in early about talking about best practice for Employment First Medicaid incentives, and then the particular question was, what can states do to adjust provider reimbursements so that beneficiaries are getting competitive integrated employment rather than cheaper segregated sheltered work?
Yeah. Again, I feel like this is another 90-minute conversation, and there are certainly folks in our APSE network that are much more much better positioned to get into the nuances of an answer to this question, but it really comes down to how you prioritize services and support. So one of the difficulties is looking at the cost over time, because we can say, you know, it is cheaper in the short term to have someone in a sheltered environment, but if that person stays there for the rest of their lives, then that is accrued cost versus an upfront cost, which we know is higher for something like supported employment, but leads to the eventual ability to phase off of those supports and for someone to work competitively in a good job match utilizing natural supports, which, again, this is the goal, right? So that's the goal of what Employment First is about, is to get to those good job matches. That does require incentivizing in a way that makes it possible for service providers to actually do the work. It is more costly in the upfront. We know that, but that it's not about the upfront. It's about the long-term goal. And in this fiscal climate, those are difficult decisions that are having to be made. But I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing is more and more providers, supported employment providers, who are closing their doors because they simply can't compete. And that's not incentivizing in the direction that we want to go. But yeah, it's a much more complicated answer than that. I know I'm scratching the surface here. Barry, what would you add?
No, I think you answered that perfectly.
Okay.
Got nothing to add.
Great. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Barry. Jeff, do we have any questions on the telephone at this time from our telephone participants?
There are no questions at this time. Presenters, you may continue.
Okay, thank you. Barry, someone had submitted a question slash comment. If you could just, they were unclear on the four goals of the ADA and where that came from and tying that into the Employment First.
Yeah.
So if you'd just mind addressing
that. Yeah, well,
thing.
Right. So those are the aspirational goals at the time the ADA was signed into law. You know, what's the purpose of this law? What are we trying to accomplish? You know, and when you break down the five titles of the ADA, What it comes down to are those four foundational pillars of full participation, of independent living, equality of opportunity, and economic self-sufficiency. So those were the intent at the time the law was signed. Those were the aspirational goals of the law. And so what we were hoping to do today was to take a look at Employment First as a movement and as a policy, and then how do they marry, how do they align with the, you know, between the intent of Employment First and the intent of ADA. So that's what we were trying to do.
Okay, great. So, thank you. Yep,
sure.
Go ahead, Barry, sorry.
No, I'm just saying those were the intent of the law in 1990.
All right, great. And the next question, you've seen this, but let me get this so our captioner can include it. So this participant wanted you to address the challenges of for rural communities and potential ways to combat lack of transportation, lack of job market, and limited access to technology, and the all too often, quote, door slam that comes from rural-based resource agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And lack of services, just to finish up the question. So go ahead, Julie.
So, Barry, do you want
to? Well, yeah, I'll go ahead and start. Yeah, so... And trying to break this down a little bit and kind of give you a little context, Southeast ADA Center serves the Southeast U.S. So we have these pockets of tremendous wealth. You know, you think of Miami, you think of Atlanta. We have 11 cities in the region with a million or more people. You know, in our areas, essentially from Louisville down to Miami and west. But then we also see these tremendous pockets of poverty. You know, I can look out my window and know that 50 miles from, I'm sitting in Kentucky today, 50 miles from where I'm sitting is the Cumberland Plateau and the Appalachian Range and just the extreme poverty there, as well as having spent time in the Mississippi Delta and just the extreme poverty that exists there. So the challenges are different. The challenges are rural, are different and real in those rural areas, but they certainly can be overcome. You know, if we look at transportation resources, we've seen ride sharing that has gone into effect. We have a lot of success in the rural areas that I have served with you know developing carpooling and those opportunities for people when you have other folks who are going to the same place. Those jobs are still there. There is still need in those rural areas. And sometimes it takes a great deal of talent for employment professionals to find those jobs. I will tell you that at the same time, a lot of the work that I've done in Eastern Kentucky, some of the most successful job coaches were in that area because of the personal relationships that they had developed with those employers in those communities. Because at the end of the day, you know, how do people find jobs, right? It's not what you know, but who you know. And having something that we stress anytime we talk about job development and employment services is the development of those personal relationships with employers to fill employment needs. Now that, you know, sometimes that need is a standard job description, but oftentimes it is customized work. It's taking a look at what are the needs of your business, what things are not being completed, and how can someone who I represent then complete those tasks and fulfill your needs at the business. You know, so it's often not a job description, but it's customized work for folks. I don't know if I answered the question or not. So, Julie,
That was a great answer. I think I would add to that, and so my professional background is, you know, 20 years working in New York State, and then I most recently lived in Iowa. Very different experiences. But what I learned from that is that we make a lot of assumptions about rural versus urban
right.
that don't always in practicality ring true. I mean, in some respects, we see better outcomes in rural areas because there's more flexibility often versus, you know, in an urban area where you can say, oh, well, the transportation barrier goes away, except that so along with removing the transportation barrier comes much higher competition for the same job. And so, you know, I think one of the challenges, and I say this as a policy person who currently now works in the greater DC area, is that policy has to be flexible enough that it's not a cookie cutter approach. And that what works in, you know, Southwest Iowa is not going to work in the San Francisco Bay Area. But, you know, I still go back to what are the founding principles upon which, you know, upon which these policies are enacted, which is why I think, you know, Barry's point of what was the intent of the ADA is so critical. And I say the same thing when it comes to Employment First. It really doesn't matter to me what color a state is on a map. What matters to me is what are the outcomes within the context of your state, and do we have policies that align in a way that support that to happen? And I think we sometimes get caught up in a one-size-fits-all, but it's also a very tricky line to cross because in under-resourced communities, it can be very easy to default to the easiest, which is not necessarily competitive integrated employment. So where is the accountability, you know, which is why, you know, we really push for people really internalizing what are the principles of Employment First. Do we absolutely believe that everybody can work if we put the right training supports, you know, et cetera, in place for that person and are able to find a good job match? You know, because we have the examples of making that happen. How do we scale that up for every individual, knowing that, you know, we don't have capacity within our service system right now to do that? Anyway.
Yep. Good point.
Yep. Great. Thank you both. Barry, you'd mentioned, you know, the you know, after school jobs, and Julia talked about your 16-year-old self working at McDonald's. Do you have examples, best practices, you know, for those situations where, you know, persons with disabilities at those younger age aren't getting those first job opportunities? You found out, Julie, that at 16 you didn't want to work at McDonald's. What are examples of where those people with disabilities are getting those same opportunities or getting volunteer opportunities to learn what they like, what they want to do as a career?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think this is, again, intent of WIOA and implementation are two different things. This is my personal opinion, but I think education, K-12 education, there's a lot more that could be done to ensure that youth have opportunities beyond sending a group of, you know, five people from a special ed classroom out to, you know, wherever you send them. You know, those aren't individualized placements. So, you know, do we have a K-12 system that has the same goals and understands how to provide those supports? And really what I think the genius of WIOA is that theoretically it's that opportunity for the post K-12 system and the K-12 system to learn from each other and to partner together towards outcomes across the board, regardless of what age. I'm not sure in implementation we're actually seeing that happen to the extent that the law was intending it to be. But there are some good models. There are, you know, there's programs like, and this isn't an endorsement of anything, but just examples. There's programs like Project Search, for example, that are a collaboration between vocational rehabilitation, DD services, community business, and K-12 education that focuses on individual discovery with the goal of employment. And Project Search as a national model is getting 80% plus outcomes of young people exiting school into competitive integrated employment, according to WIOA's definition. So we know it can happen, but a program like Project Search is not free to run. So where are we aligning our systems and our funding to incentivize that employment in the community, competitive integrated employment, is an outcome that we stand behind for students in K-12 education. There's work to be done there.
Yeah, and well, I think you raise a very interesting point with Project Search. Just to bring it home, Julie, is that the intent, you know, for transitioning youth, we shouldn't be looking at the outcome. We should be looking at a process of discovery. I can't tell you how many times I took a job and just hated it. Actually, my first job between high school and college, just since you were sharing, was working at the Louisville freezer plant in the middle of the summer, and that was the most miserable job I ever had, and it was like, I never want to do this again. You know, the other thing is, and we had this conversation, myself and a couple of folks this morning, in regard to education, is we really are doing a disservice to job seekers if we are only looking at that educational attainment that can be found in, you know, a post-secondary 2 or a post-secondary 4-year education. We need to look at where the demand is now and where jobs are not being filled. I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other night whose daughter just was kind of lost, didn't want to go to 4-year college, didn't know what she wanted to do. She enrolled a couple of years ago in a welding program at the community college, and she's making money hand over fist and just loving it, you know. So we need to look at where those pockets of need are and then match the skills, interests, and abilities of people up with those jobs, you know, where that need is.
Right. And you had mentioned the culture of the assessment as part of K-12 education. And I think that can't be emphasized enough, because it places youth with disabilities at a disincentive, right? So, you know, you don't do well at a job does not equate to I can't work.
Right.
It means I couldn't do that job for whatever reason. I didn't like it or it wasn't my skill set. We don't have that same bar for students in the K-12 system without disabilities. You know, so it's part of it is that dignity of risk and helping, you know, the professionals and the family members that support that individual that, you know, that first job at McDonald's is not going to be what you do for the rest of your life. And if you're not good at it, you need to go find what you are good at, not just have that be written off as a failure.
Sure. And what's the quote applied to Edison? Edison was asked, how's it fail 1,000 times, and Edison replied, I didn't fail. You know, I just learned 1,000 things that didn't work, right?
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you for the excellent presentation information, and thanks for the great discussion for the past 30 minutes or more. We are unfortunately at the bottom of the hour, and we could have continued on, but thank you, Julie and Barry, for joining us today, and not just for the 90-plus minutes that you've been with us, but for the time preparing for today's session. Both Barry and Julie's complete bios are available on the ada-audio.org website if you want to get more information about them and the organizations they are connected with. Invite all of you to join us on February 18th. That will be the date of the next ADA audio conference session. That session is Disability, Diversity, and Inclusion, Lessons Learned from Industry Leaders. And again, that will be from 2 to 3:30 Eastern Time, February the 18th. You can find it, more information and register for that session by visiting ada-audio.org. As a reminder, the session was recorded, and the audio recording and handout materials will be posted to ada-audio.org within 24 hours. An edited transcript will follow in a couple weeks' time. So thanks again to our presenters today, and most of all, thank you for all of for joining all of us today. Encourage you to complete the evaluations for today's sessions. That helps us, that helps our presenters, that helps us understand what information, what topics you want to see covered in the future. So thanks again to everyone. If you have questions about the audio conference, contact us at 877-232-1990. If you want information about your regional ADA center, visit adata.org. Thanks again, everyone. Enjoy the remainder of your Tuesday. Good day.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.